They saw the new equator line in person, the southernmost one anyway, on the second night of their flight toward Shalbatana Vallis. In the dark, it was a broad, straight black swath leading them west. As they flew over it, Nadia stared down somberly. It hadn't been her project, but it was work, and work destroyed, a bridge brought down. And that black line was also a grave. Not many people on the surface had been killed, except on the east side of Pavonis, but most, if not all of those on the elevator must have been, and that in itself meant several thousand people. Most of whom had probably been all right until their part of the cable hit the atmosphere and burned up. As they flew over the wreckage, Sachs intercepted a new video of the fall. Someone had already stitched up a chronological montage from all the images that had been sent onto the net live, or in the hours immediately afterward. In this montage, a very effective bit of work, the final clips were of the last section of the cable exploding into the landscape. The impact zone was never anything but a moving white blob, like a flaw in the tape. No video was capable of registering such illumination. But as the montage continued, the images had been slowed down and processed in every possible way, and one of these processed images was the final clip, an ultra-slow motion shot in which one could see details that would have been impossible to spot live. And so they could see that as the line had crossed the sky, the burning graphite had stripped away first, leaving an incandescent double helix of diamond, flowing majestically out of a sunset sky. All a gravestone, of course. The people on it already dead at that point, burned away. But it was hard to think of them when the image was so utterly strange and beautiful, a vision of some kind of fantasy DNA, DNA from a macro world made of pure light, plowing into our universe to germinate a barren planet. Nadia stopped watching the TV, moved into the co-pilot seat to help spot the other plane. All that long night, she stared out the window, unable to sleep, unable to get the image of that diamond descent out of her mind's eye. It was the longest night of their trip so far, for her. It seemed a kind of eternity before dawn came. But time passed, another night of their lives, and at last dawn came. Soon after sunrise, they landed at a pipeline service airstrip above Shalbatana, and stayed with a group of refugees who had been working on the pipeline and were now caught there. This group had no political stance in common and wanted only to survive until things got back to normal. Nadia found their attitude only partly refreshing and tried to get them to go out and repair pipelines, but she didn't think they were convinced. That evening, they took off once more, again laden with supplies given to them by their hosts, and the following dawn they landed on the abandoned airstrip of Carr Crater. Before 8, Nadia and Sachs and Anne and Simon and Sasha and Yelly were out in walkers and up to the crater rim. The dome was gone. There had been a fire below. All the buildings were intact, but scorched, and almost all their windows had been broken or melted. Plastic walls were bent or deformed. Concrete was blackened. There were splashes of soot scattered everywhere, and piles of soot scattered here and there on the ground, little heaps of blackened carbon. Sometimes they looked like Hiroshima shadows. Yes, they were bodies. The outlines of people trying to claw down through the sidewalks. The city's air was hyperoxygenated, Sachs ventured. In such an atmosphere, human skin and flesh were combustible and flammable. That was what had happened to those early Apollo astronauts, stuck in a test capsule filled with an atmosphere of pure oxygen. When the fire started, they had burnt like paraffin. And so here. Everyone on the streets had caught fire and rushed around like torches. One could see that by the placement of the soot piles. The six old friends walked down together into the shadow of the eastern crater wall. Under a circular dark pink sky, they stopped at the first clutch of blackened bodies and then walked quickly on. They opened doors in buildings when it was possible and knocked on all the jammed doors and listened at the walls with a stethoscope device Sachs had brought along. No sound but their own heartbeats, loud and fast at the backs of their coppery throats. Nadia stumbled around, her breath harsh and ragged. She forced herself to look at the bodies she passed, trying to estimate heights from the black piles of carbon. Like Hiroshima or Pompeii, people were taller now. They still burnt to the bone, though, and even the bones were thin black sticks. When she came to a likely-sized pile, she stood staring at it. After a while, she approached and found the right arm and scraped with her four-fingered glove at the back of the charred wrist bones, looking for the dot code tag. She found it, cleaned it, ran her laser over it like a grocery clerk pricing goods. Emily Hargrove. She moved on, did it again with another likely-sized pile. Thabo Moatai. It was better than checking teeth against dental records, but she wouldn't have done that. She was light-headed and numb when she came to a soot pile near the city offices. Alone, its right hand splayed out so that she only had to check. She cleaned the tag and checked. Arkady Nikolayevich Bogdanov. They flew west for 11 more days, hiding through the daylight hours under stealth blankets or taking shelter with people they encountered en route. During the nights, they followed transponders or the directions of the last group with which they had stayed. Though these groups often knew of each other's existence and location, they were definitely not parts of a single resistance or coordinated in any way. Some hoped to make it to the South Polar Cap like the prisoners from Korolyov. Others had never heard of this refuge. Some were Bogdanovists, others were revolutionaries following different leaders, and some were religious communes or utopian experiments, or nationalist groups trying to contact their governments back home. And some were merely collections of survivors without a program, orphaned by the violence. The six travelers even stopped at Korolyov itself, but they didn't attempt to enter when they saw the naked frozen bodies of guards outside the locks, some of them propped in standing positions like statues. After Korolyov, they encountered no one. The radios and TVs went dead as satellites were shot out. The pistes were empty, and the Earth was on the other side of the sun. The landscape seemed as barren as before their arrival, except for the spreading patches of frost. They flew on as if they were the only people in the world, the sole survivors. White noise buzzed in Nadia's ear, something to do with the plane's ventilators, no doubt. She checked the ventilators, but they were okay. The others gave her chores to do, let her go on walks by herself before takeoff and after landing. They were stunned themselves by what they had found at Kar and Korolyov, and unable to bring much to the effort of cheering her up, which she found a relief. Anne and Simon were still worried about Peter. Yelly and Sax were worried about their food supplies dropping all the time. The plane's cabinets were nearly bare. But Arkady was dead, and so none of that mattered. The revolt seemed to Nadia more a waste than ever, an unfocused spasm of rage, the ultimate cutting off of one's nose to spite one's face. The whole world wrecked. She told the others to send out a radio message on one of the general channels, announcing that Arkady was dead. Sasha agreed and helped convince the others to do it. "It will help stop things more quickly," Sasha said. Sax shook his head. "Insurrections don't have leaders," he said. "Besides, no one is likely to hear it." But a couple of days later, it was clear some people had heard it. They received a microburst in response from Alex Jalin. "Look, Sax, this isn't the American Revolution, or the French, or the Russian, or the English. It's all the revolutions at once, and everywhere. A whole world is in revolt, with a land area equal to Earth's, and only a few thousand people are trying to stop it, and most of those are still in space, where they have a good view but are very vulnerable. So if they manage to subdue a force in Sirtis, there's another in the Hellespontus. Imagine space-based forces trying to stop a revolution in Cambodia, but also in Alaska, Japan, Spain, Madagascar. How do you do it? You can't. I only wish that Arkady Nikolayevich had lived to see it. He would have... The microburst ended abruptly. Perhaps a bad sign, perhaps not. But even Alex hadn't been able to keep a note of discouragement out of his voice when he talked about Arkady. It was impossible. Arkady had been so much more than a political leader, everybody's brother, a natural force, the voice of one's conscience, one's innate sense of what was fair and just, one's best friend. Nadia stumped through her grief, helping to navigate their flights by night, sleeping as much as she could through the days. She lost weight. Her hair turned pure white, all the remaining gray and black hairs coming out in her brush. She found it hard to speak. It felt like her throat and guts had petrified. She was a stone. It was impossible to weep. She went about her business instead. No one they met had any food to spare, and they were running out themselves. They set a strict rationing schedule, dividing meals in half. And on the 32nd day of their journey from Laswitz, after a journey of some 10,000 kilometers, they came to Cairo, up on the southern rim of Noctis Labyrinthus, just to the south of the southernmost strand of the fallen cable. Cairo was under the de facto control of UNOMA, in that no one in the city had ever claimed otherwise, and like all the rest of the big tent cities, it lay helpless under the orbiting lasers of UNOMA police ships, which had burned into orbit sometime in the last month. Also, most of the inhabitants of Cairo at the beginning of the war had been Arab and Swiss, and in Cairo at least, people of both nationalities seemed only to be trying to stay out of harm's way. Now, however, the six travelers were not the only refugees arriving. A flood of them had just come down Tharsis from the devastation in Sheffield and the rest of Pavonis. Others were driving up from Marineris through the maze of Noctis. The city was at quadruple capacity, with crowds living and sleeping in the streets and parks, the physical plant strained to the breaking point, and food and gases running out. The six travelers were told this by an airstrip worker who was still stubbornly doing her job, although none of the strip shuttles were running anymore. After guiding them into parking places among a great fleet of planes at one end of the strip, she told them to suit up and walk the kilometer to the city wall. It made Nadia unreasonably nervous to leave the two 16Ds behind and walk into a city. And she wasn't reassured once through the lock when she saw that most people inside were wearing their walkers and carrying their helmets with them, ready for depressurization if it came. They went to the city offices and there found Frank and Maya, as well as Mary Dunkel and Spencer Jackson. They all greeted each other with relief, but there was no time for catching up on their various adventures. Frank was busy before a screen, talking to someone in orbit by the sound of it, and he shrugged off their hugs and kept talking, waving once later to acknowledge their appearance. Apparently he was hooked into a functioning communication system, or even more than one, because he stayed in front of the screen talking to one face or another for the next 6 hours straight, pausing only to sip water or make another call, not sparing another glance for his old compatriots. He seemed to be in a permanent fury, his jaw muscles bunching and unbunching rhythmically. Other than that, he was in his element, explaining and lecturing, wheedling and threatening, inquiring and then commenting impatiently on the answers he got. Wheeling and dealing in his old style, in other words, but with an angry, bitter, even frightened edge, as if he had walked off a cliff and was trying to argue his way back to ground. When he finally clicked off, he leaned back in his seat and sighed histrionically, then rose stiffly from his seat and came over to greet them, putting a hand briefly on Nadia's shoulder. Aside from that, he was brusque with all of them and completely uninterested in how they had managed to make it to Cairo. He only wanted to know whom they had met and where and how well these scattered parties were doing and what they intended. Once or twice, he went back to his screen and contacted these groups immediately upon being informed of their location, an ability that stunned the travelers who had assumed that everyone was as cut off as they had been. Unoma Lynx, Frank explained, running a hand over his swarthy jaw. They're keeping some channels open for me. Why? Sack said. Because I'm trying to stop this. I'm trying for a ceasefire, then a general amnesty, then a reconstruction joined by all. But under whose direction? Unoma's, of course, and the national offices. But Unoma agrees only to the ceasefire, Sachs ventured, while the rebels only agree to the general amnesty? Frank nodded curtly. And neither like the reconstruction joined by all, but the current situation is so bad they may go for it. 4 more aquifers have blown since the cable came down. They're all equatorial, and some people are saying it's cause and effect. Anne shook her head at this, and Frank looked pleased to see it. They were broken open, I was pretty sure. They broke one at the mouth of Chasma Borealis. It's pouring out onto the Borealis dunes. The weight of the polar cap probably puts that one under a good bit of pressure, Anne said. Do you know what happened to the Acheron group? Sachs asked Frank. No, they've disappeared. It might be like with Arcady, I'm afraid. He glanced at Nadia, pursed his lips unhappily. I should get back to work. But what's happening on Earth? Anne demanded. What does the UN have to say about all this? Mars is not a nation, but a world resource, Frank quoted heavily. They're saying that the tiny fraction of humanity that lives here can't be allowed to control the resources when the human material base as a whole is so deeply stressed. That's probably true, Nadia heard herself say. Her voice was harsh, a croak. It felt like she hadn't spoken in days. Frank shrugged. Sachs said, I suppose that's why they've given the transnationals such a free hand. It seems to me there's more of their security here than UN police. That's right, Frank said. It took the UN a while to agree to deploy their peacekeepers. They don't mind having the dirty work done by someone else. Of course not. And Earth itself? Anne asked again. Frank shrugged. The group of 7 seems to be getting things under control. He shook his head. It's hard to say from here. It really is. He went to his screen to make more calls. The others went off to eat, to clean up, to sleep, to catch up on friends and acquaintances, on the rest of the first 100, on what news there was from Earth. The flags of convenience had been destroyed by attacks from the have-nots in the south, but apparently the transnationals had fled to the group of 7 and had been taken in and defended by the 7's giant militaries. The 12th attempt at a ceasefire had held for several days now. So they had a bit of time to try and recover, but when they went through the comm room, Frank would still be there, shifting ever more surely into a bitter black fury, snapping his way through what seemed an endless nightmare of screen diplomacy, talking on and on in an urgent, scornful, biting tone. He was past cajoling anyone into anything now. It was purely an exertion of will, trying to move the world without a fulcrum, or with the weakest of fulcrums, his leverage consisting mainly of his old American connections and his current personal standing with a variety of insurrection leaders, both nearly severed by events and the TV blackouts, and both becoming less important daily on Mars itself, as Unoma and the transnational forces took over town after town. It seemed to Nadia that Frank was now trying to muscle the process along by the sheer force of his anger at his lack of influence. She found she couldn't stand to be around him. Things were bad enough without his black bile. But with Sax's help, he got an independent signal to Earth by contacting Vega and getting the technicians there to transmit messages back and forth. That meant a few hours between transmission and reception. But in a long couple of days after that, he got in 5 coded exchanges with Secretary of State Wu, and while waiting through the night for return messages, the people on Vega filled the gaps with tapes of Terran news programs that they hadn't seen. All these reports, when they referred to the Martian situation at all, portrayed the insurrection as a minor disruption caused by criminal elements, principally by escaped prisoners from Korolyov, who had gone on a rampage of senseless property damage, in the process killing great numbers of innocent civilians. Clips of the frozen naked guards outside Korolyov were featured prominently in these reports, as were satellite telephotos of the aquifer outbursts. The most skeptical programs mentioned that these and all other clips from Mars were provided by UNOMA, and some stations in China and the Netherlands even questioned the accuracy of the UNOMA accounts. But they provided no alternative explanation of events, and for the most part, the Terran media disseminated the transnationals' version of things. When Nadia pointed this out, Frank snorted. "Of course," he said contemptuously. "Terran news is transnational." He turned off the sound. Behind him, Nadia and Yelly leaned forward instinctively on the bamboo couch, as if that might help them to hear the silent clip better. Their 2 weeks of being cut off from outside news had seemed like a year, and now they watched the screen helplessly, soaking in whatever information they could. Yelly even stood to turn the sound back up, but saw that Frank was asleep in his chair, his chin on his chest. When a message from the State Department came in, Frank jerked awake, turned up the sound, stared at the tiny faces on the screen, snapped out a reply in a hoarse rasp. Then he closed his eyes and slept again. At the end of the second night of the Vega link, he had gotten Secretary Wu to promise to press the UN in New York to restore communications and halt all police action until the situation could be assessed. Wu was also going to try to get transnational forces ordered back to Earth, though that, Frank noted, would be impossible. The sun had been up for a couple of hours when Frank sent a final acknowledgement to Vega and shut down. Yelly was asleep on the floor. Nadia stood up stiffly and went for a walk around the park, taking advantage of the light to have a look around. She had to step over bodies sleeping in the grass, in groups of three or four spooned together for warmth. The Swiss had set up big kitchens and rows of outhouses lining the city wall. It looked like a construction site, and suddenly she found tears running down her face. On she walked. It was nice to be able to walk around in the open light of day. Eventually, she returned to the city offices. Frank was standing over Maya, who was asleep on a couch. He stared down at her with a blank expression, then looked up bleary-eyed at Nadia. "She's really out."
"Everyone's tired."
"Hm." "What was it like at Hellas?"
"Underwater."
He shook his head. "Sax must be loving it."
"That's what I kept saying, but I think it's too out of control for him."
"Ah, yes." He closed his eyes, appeared to sleep for a second or two. "I'm sorry about Arkady."
"Yes."
Another silence. "She looks like a girl."
"A little."
Actually, Nadia had never seen Maya look older. They were all pushing 80. They couldn't keep the pace, treatments or not. In their minds, they were old. "The folks on Vega told me that Phyllis and the rest of the people on Clark are going to try to get across to them in an emergency rocket."
"Aren't they out of the plane of the ecliptic?"
"They are now, but they're going to try to push down to Jupiter and use it to swing back down system."
"That'll take a year or two, won't it?"
"About a year. Hopefully they'll miss entirely, or fall into Jupiter, or run out of food."
"I take it you're not happy with Phyllis."
"That bitch. She's responsible for a lot of this. Pulling in all those transnats with promises of every metal ever put to use. She figured she would be Queen of Mars with all those folks backing her. You should have seen her up there on Clark, looking down at the planet like a little tin god. I could have strangled her. How I wish I could have seen her face when Clark took off and went flying." He laughed harshly. Maya stirred at the sound, woke. They pulled her up and went out into the park in search of a meal. They got in a line of people huddled in their walkers, coughing, rubbing their hands together, blowing out plumes of frost like white cotton balls. Very few talked. Frank surveyed the scene with a disgusted look, and when they got their trays of roche tea and tabbouleh, he devoured his and began conversing to his wristpad in Arabic. "They say Alex and Evgenia and Samantha are coming up Noctis with some Bedouin friends of mine," he told them when he shut down. That was good news. Alex and Evgenia had been heard from last in Orium Overlook, a rebel bastion that had destroyed a number of orbiting UN ships before being incinerated by missile fire from Phobos, and no one had heard from Samantha the whole month of the war. So all the first 100 in town went to the north gate of Cairo that afternoon to greet them. Cairo's north gate looked down a long natural ramp that ran into one of the southernmost canyons of Noctis. The road rose up from the canyon floor on this ramp, and they could see all the way down it to the canyon bottom. There in the early afternoon came a rover caravan, churning up a small dust cloud and moving slowly. It was nearly an hour before the cars rolled up the last part of the ramp. They were no more than 3 kilometers away when great gouts of flame and ejecta burst into being among them, knocking some rovers into the cliff wall, some over the ramp into space. The rest twisted to a halt, shattered and burning. Then an explosion rocked the north gate, and they dove for the wall, cries and shouts over the common band, "Nothing more." They stood back up. The fabric of the tent still held, although the gate lock was apparently stuck fast. Down on the road, thin plumes of tan smoke lofted into the air, tattering to the east, pulled back down into Noctis on the dusk wind. Nadia sent a robot rover down to check for survivors. Wristpads crackled with static, nothing but static, and Nadia was thankful for that. What could they have hoped for? Screams? Frank was cursing into his wristpad, switching between Arabic and English, trying vainly to find out what had happened. But Alexander, Evgenia, Samantha. Nadia looked fearfully at the little images on her wrist, directing the robot cameras with dread. Shattered rovers. Some bodies. Nothing moved. One rover still smoked. "Where's Sasha?" Yelly's voice cried. "Where's Sasha?" "She was in the lock," someone said. "She was going out to greet them." They went to work opening the inner lock door, Nadia at the front punching all the codes, and then working with tools, and finally a shape charge that someone handed to her. They moved back, and the lock blew out like a crossbow bolt, and then they were there, crowbarring the heavy door back. Nadia rushed in and dropped to her knees by Sasha, who was huddled, head in jacket, in the emergency posture. But she was dead. The flesh of her face, Martian red, her eyes frozen. Feeling that she had to move or else turn to stone on the spot, Nadia broke and ran back to the town cars they had come in. She jumped in one and drove away. She had no plan, and the car seemed to choose the direction. Her friends' voices cut through the crackle on her wrist pad, sounding like crickets in a cage, Maya muttering viciously in Russian, crying. Only Maya was tough enough to keep feeling in all of this. "That was Phobos again," her little voice cried. "They're psychotic up there." The others were in shock, their voices like AIs. "They're not psychotic," Frank said. "It's perfectly rational. They see a political settlement coming, and they're getting in as many shots as they can." "Murderous bastards," Maya cried. "KGB fascists!" The town car stopped at the city offices. Nadia ran inside to the room where she had stashed her stuff, at this point no more than her old blue backpack. She dug in it, still unaware of what she was looking for, until her claw hand, still the strong one, reached into a bag and pulled it out. Arkady's transmitter. Of course. She ran back to the car and drove to the south gate. Sax and Frank were still talking, Sax sounding the same as always, but saying, "Every one of us whose location is known is either here or else been killed. I think they're after the first 100 in particular."
"Singling us out, you mean?" Frank said.
"I saw some Terran news that said we were the ringleaders, and 21 of us have died since the revolt began.
another 40 missing.
The town car arrived at the south gate. Nadia turned off her intercom, got out of the car, went into the lock, and put on boots, helmet, gloves. She pumped up and checked out, then slammed the open button and waited for the lock to empty and open, as it had on Sasha. They had lived a lifetime together in just the last month alone. Then she was out onto the surface, into the glare and push of a windy, hazy day, feeling the first diamond bite of the cold. She kicked through drifts of fines and red puffs blew out ahead of her. The hollow woman, kicking blood. Out the other gate were the bodies of her friends and others, their dead faces purplish and bloated, as after construction accidents. Nadia had seen several of those now, seen death several times, and each had been a horror. And yet here they were, deliberately creating as many of these horrible accidents as they could. That was war, killing people by every means possible, people who might have lived 1,000 years. She thought of Arkady and of 1,000 years, and hissed. They had quarreled so in recent years, mostly about politics. "Your plans are all anachronism," Nadia had said. "You don't understand the world." "Ha!" he had laughed, offended. "This world I understand." With an expression as dark as any she had ever seen from him, and she remembered, when he had given her the transmitter, how he had cried for John, how crazy he had been with rage and grief. "Just in case," he had said to her refusals pleading. "Just in case." And now it had happened. She couldn't believe it. She took the box from her walker's thigh pocket, turned it over in her hand. Phobos shot up over the western horizon like a gray potato. The sun had just set, and the alpenglow was so strong that it looked like she was standing in her own blood, as if she were a creature as small as a cell standing on the corroded wall of her heart, while around her swept the winds of her own dusty plasma. Rockets were landing at the spaceport north of the city. The dusk mirrors gleamed in the western sky like a cluster of evening stars, a busy sky. UN ships would soon be descending. Phobos crossed the sky in 4 1/4 hours, so she didn't have to wait long. It had risen as a half-moon, but now it was gibbous, almost full, halfway to the zenith, moving at its steady clip across the coagulating sky. She could make out a faint point of light inside the gray disk. The 2 little domed craters, Semyonov and Lavakin. She held the radio transmitter out and tapped in the ignition code, Mangala. It was like using a TV remote. The bright light flared on the leading edge of the little gray disk. The 2 faint lights went out. The bright light flared even brighter. Could she really perceive the deceleration? Probably not, but it was there. Phobos was on its way down. Back inside Cairo, she found that the news had already spread. The flare had been bright enough to catch people's eyes, and after that they had clumped together around the blank TV screens by habit and exchanged rumors and speculation, and somehow the basic fact had gotten around or been worked out independently. Nadia strolled past group after group and heard people saying, "Phobos has been hit! Phobos has been hit!" And someone laughed. "They brought the Roche limit up to it." She thought she was lost in the Medina, but almost directly she came to the city offices. Maya was outside. "Hey, Nadia," she cried, "did you see Phobos?" "Yes. Roger says when they were up there in year 1, they built a system of explosives and rocketry into it. Did Arkady ever tell you about it?" "Yes." They went into the offices, Maya thinking aloud. "If they manage to slow it down very much, it'll come down. I wonder if it'll be possible to calculate where. We're pretty damn close to the equator right here. It'll break up, surely, and come down in a lot of places." "True. I wonder what Sachs thinks." They found Sachs and Frank bunched before one screen, Yelly and Anne and Simon before another.
A Unoma satellite was tracking Phobos with a telescope, and Sax was measuring the moon's speed of passage across the Martian landscape to get a fix on its velocity. In the image on the screen, Stickney's dome shone like a Fabergé egg, but the eye was drawn away from that to the moon's leading edge, which was blurry and streaked with white flashes of ejecta and gases. "Look how well balanced the thrust is," Sax said to no one in particular. "Too sudden a thrust and the whole thing would have shattered, and an unbalanced thrust would have set it spinning, and then the thrust would have pushed it all over the place." "I see signs of stabilizing lateral thrusts," his AI said. "Attitude jets," Sax said. "They turned Phobos into a big rocket." "They did it in the first year," Nadia said. She wasn't sure why she was speaking. She still seemed out of control, observing her actions from several seconds behind. "A lot of the Phobos crew was from rocketry and guidance. They processed the ice veins into liquid oxygen and deuterium and stored it in lined columns buried in the chondrite. The engines in the control complex were buried centrally." "So it is a big rocket," Sax was nodding as he typed. "Period of Phobos, 27,547 seconds. So it's going. 2.146 kilometers per second, approximately, and to bring it down, it needs to decelerate to 1.561 kilometers per second. So, 0.585 kilometers per second slower. For a mass like Phobos, wow, that's a lot of fuel." "What's it down to now?" Frank asked. He was black-faced, his jaw muscles pulsing under the skin like little biceps. Furious, Nadia saw, at his inability to predict what would happen next. "About 1.7. And those big thrusters still burning. It'll come down, but not in one piece. The descent will break it up, I'm sure." "The Roche limit?" "No, just stress from aerobraking, and with all these empty fuel chambers." "What happened to the people on it?" Nadia heard herself ask. "Someone came on and said it sounded like the whole population had bailed out. No one stuck around to try and stop the firing." "Good," Nadia said, sitting down heavily on the couch. "So when will it come down?" Frank demanded. Sax blinked. "Impossible to say. Depends on when it breaks up and how. But pretty soon, I'd guess. Within a day. And then there'll be a stretch somewhere along the equator, probably a big stretch of it, in big trouble. It's going to make a fairly large meteor shower." "That will clear away some of the elevator cable," Simon said weakly. He was sitting beside Anne, watching her with concern. She stared at Simon's screen bleakly, showed no sign of hearing any of them. There never had been word of their son Peter. Was that better or worse than a soot pile? A dot code name coming up on your wrist pad? Better, Nadia decided, but still hard. "Look," Sax said, "it's breaking up." The satellite telescopic camera gave them an excellent view. The dome over Stickney burst outward in great shards, and the crater pit lines that had always marked Phobos suddenly puffed with dust, yawning open. Then the little potato-shaped world blossomed, fell apart into a scattering of irregular chunks. A half a dozen large ones slowly spread out, the largest one leading the way. One chunk flew off to the side, apparently powered still by one of the rockets that had lain buried in the moon's interior. The rest of the rocks began to spread out in an irregular line, tumbling each at a different speed. "Well, we're kind of in the line of fire," Sax remarked, looking up at the rest of them. "The biggest chunks will hit the upper atmosphere soon, and then it'll happen pretty quickly." "Can you determine where?" "No, there's too many unknowns. Along the equator, that's all. We're probably far enough south to miss most of it, but there may be quite a scatter effect."
"People on the equator ought to head north or south," Maya said.
"They probably know that. Anyway, the fall of the cable probably cleared the area pretty effectively already." There was little to do but wait. None of them wanted to leave the city and head south. It seemed they were past that kind of effort. too hardened or too tired to worry about long-shot risks. Frank paced the room, his swarthy face working with anger. Finally, he couldn't stand it and got back on his screen to send off a sequence of short, pungent messages. One came back in, and he snorted. "We've got a grace period, because the UN police are afraid to come down here until after the shit falls. After that, they'll be on us like hawks. They're claiming that the command initiating the Phobos explosions originated here, and they're tired of a neutral city being used as a command center for the insurrection." "So we've got until the fall is over," Sack said. He clicked into the Unoma network and got a radar composite of the fragments. After that, there was nothing to do. They sat. They stood and walked around. They looked at the screens. They ate cold pizza. They napped. Nadia did none of these things. She could only manage to sit, hunched over her stomach, which felt like an iron walnut in her. She waited.